You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to The Archaeology Show. TAS goes behind the headlines to bring you the real stories about archaeology and the history around us. Welcome to the podcast. Hello and welcome to the Archaeology Podcast, episode 29. I'm Chris Webster.
And I'm April Camp Whitaker. On today's show, we'll talk to Paul Bond, author of the newly released book on European rock art, Images of the Ice Age, from Oxford University Press.
Let's dig a little deeper. Okay, welcome to the Archaeology Show. Now, I'll let our listeners know right off the bat, we've had some connectivity issues because April is traveling, so she's not going to be part of the introduction right now, but she may just pop in later if she can get it figured out and can join the conversation. So, we're going to proceed on with the interview because this is a cross-continent, cross-ocean interview for us, again, with Oxford University Press, similar to the Barry Cunliffe episode we did a couple months ago. So go check that out. It'll be in the show notes. But today, our guest is Dr. Paul Bond. Dr. Bond is a British archaeologist that has done extensive work in studying prehistoric art, most notably Paleolithic rock art. Since the mid-1980s, Dr. Bond has been a freelance writer and has written, edited, and translated books on archaeology. Dr. Bond is also the co-author of a book that nearly every archaeologist that I know of has used or at least heard of, Archaeology, Theories, Methods, and Practice, written with Colin Renfrew. So, Dr. Bond, first, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Okay, and why don't you add, if you can add a little bit more to your biography that led to your interest in rock art.
My interest began really as a child, my interest in archaeology, and then within that, I always felt some kind of affinity, I don't know why, with cave art. I was attracted to pictures of it, and then when I started studying archaeology at Cambridge in the 70s, if you do archaeology at Cambridge, what you get is prehistory from the start, really, and the aspect of it that grabbed me from the start again was the cave art. And I ended up doing my PhD thesis on the prehistory of the French Pyrenees. And of course, they contain some of the best of all of the decorated Ice Age caves. And then after that, I sort of branched out and became interested in prehistoric rock art all over the world. Mm-hmm. But the cave art, the Ice Age cave art of Europe has always remained my first love, I would say.
Okay. And to help our listeners understand exactly what we're talking about, a lot of times when we hear about, I guess, cave art in Europe, it's often what's called pictographs, of course. Now, the audience for this show is assumed to not be archaeologists, so we're going to unpack a few terms as we go through here. So mm-hmm. We've got two different types of rock art, primarily pictographs and petroglyphs, and pictographs are typically painted. Yeah. Is there a reason why mostly what we see in literature and things like that is pictograph, like Lascaux and things like that? Is there a lot of petroglyph style rock art, or is pictograph just the fun stuff to really look at and photograph?
Well, that's the crucial point. Paintings are a lot more photogenic, a lot easier for readers to recognize. But in fact, in Ice Age cave art, engravings are far more numerous than paintings. They're just very, very difficult to photograph, or they're difficult for people to see what's in the photograph. You'd need to put an explanatory drawing next to them, and that's really the reason why photographs tend to dominate. People think of Altamira and Lascaux and the beautiful paintings, and they are fantastic, but they are by no means the norm. Engravings are far, far more common. Mm-hmm. And, of course, we do now also have petroglyphs from the Ice Age. We started discovering the open-air Ice Age art in the 80s and 90s, and so we have a lot of it in Portugal. We've got some in Spain, one site in France, one in Germany, and a couple along the Nile now in Egypt. So it's now looking as if actually petroglyphs were the commonest, probably, and the most normal form of Ice Age rock art, but most of it has gone, of course, being in the open air. It's just mm-hmm. survived in a few places. So what we're left with is the cave art, which has survived because it's in caves in these very stable environments. But it's a very skewed picture because we have something like 430 decorated caves and rock shelters now from the Ice Age in Eurasia. Probably just the tip of the iceberg, but even so, I think it's still really nothing compared to what we've lost in the open air.
Okay. Well, the book that we're talking about today is called images of the Ice Age, and this is again from Oxford University Press, and we'll have a link to this in the show notes so you can see it. And this is the third edition of this book. It was originally printed in 1988. What led you to write that first book and put it out?
In the 80s, I felt I'd done a fair amount of work on the subject, and I felt confident, and I was invited, of course, to write a book, Images of the Ice Age. And at the time, I was lucky enough to meet a man called Jean Vertu, who was the preeminent photographer of cave art in Europe, not just in France. He was French, but in Europe as a whole, he was the preeminent photographer and one of the nicest men you could possibly wish to meet. And he had a lot of wonderful photographs that he'd been taking with new techniques in recent years and was very, very keen to publish them. And so we got together and we did this first edition in 1988. And very sadly, Jean died just before the book was finished. But I went ahead with it with his widow's blessing. And then the second edition came out in 97. And again, a lot of Jean's photographs were used in that. But of course, by 97 already, there were new discoveries which he was never able to photograph. And now, of course, this third edition of last year, there are still quite a few of Jean's photographs still in there, but there is so much new material, so many new discoveries that unfortunately his contribution has diminished inevitably.
Well, I'd like to say real quick, April is back in the conversation. I think we've figured out our Skype issues. April, welcome back to the show.
Okay, I am now in the show, I promise. And it's really nice to meet you.
Hello, yes, nice to meet you too.
Well, let's go back to the book. So, the images, the first off, the photography in this book is quite amazing. And I'm interested especially to know, since this is the third edition, what are some of the major new discoveries that have been found that have prompted a third edition? Because unlike some textbooks where, you know, authors will put out a new edition every year, every other year, there's only been three editions in the last, 19 years. So something must have prompted wanting to write this new third edition. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Well, the first edition was actually 30 years ago. That was 88.
That was 30. Edition, jeez.
Yeah, the second edition was 20 years ago in 97.
Right.
And I'd been wanting to do a new edition for some years because there is just so much new material, so many major new discoveries, including far more of the open earth sites that I mentioned, but also major, major caves such as Cusac in France, which the public still really doesn't know anything about. It was found in 2000. They've been studying it for 17 years, but very little is published on it yet. And it's an astonishing cave. Plus, of course, the literature has exploded. We have so many new books and studies and papers that need to be taken into account. Plus, from my own point of view, the big event was 2003 when I found cave art in Britain for the first time. This was something I'd wanted to look for cave art in Britain for 30 years, and I found it the first morning we tried. It was a bit of an anticlimax, really. Oh, there it is. Okay.
Oh, there it is. Nice. I have it in my notes to actually talk about that. That's surprising to me. The first cave art found in Britain. How is that even possible? It seems like people have been over every inch of Britain because so many people have lived there over the past, I don't know how many centuries. Why do you think it hadn't been found before?
Well, all the books, for a start, all the books said there is no cave art in Britain. You get it in Spain and France and maybe a little bit Italy, but nothing in Britain. But right from the start of my studies, I thought, why not? Because we have Paleolithic occupation sites. Mm-hmm. We've got a bit of portable art from the period. And the closest French decorated cave is a cave called Gouy in Normandy near Rouen, which is really not very far from Britain. And, of course, we were still attached to France at the time. This was long before Brexit. We were northwest France at the time, so why should we not have cave art? But all of the books said no. So for a long time, I'd hatched this idea that it would be fun to go around the British caves looking. And I knew we wouldn't find paintings because they tend to be pretty visible, and somebody would have seen paintings by now. But engravings can be very, very hard to see if you're not looking for them. The reason for that is that when you make an engraving, say, on a cave wall, you have to have the light coming in from one side or the other. Mm. Otherwise, you're casting a shadow of what you're doing. You can't see what you're doing. And so with most engravings in caves, if you shine the light straight onto the wall, you'll see nothing. But if you tilt it to one side or the other, suddenly the engraving will appear. And I knew that nobody had been through the British caves looking for engravings with oblique lights, and so that's what we set out to do. I got a couple of colleagues and friends to do this with me, and there was a lot of luck involved, but the very first morning we went to Creswell Crags. This is a beautiful little limestone valley in the north of England. It's on the border of Nottinghamshire and Derbyshire, and it is the most important collection of Ice Age dwellings that we have in Britain, and it had produced already the only figurative portable art that we had of the period, so it seemed like a likely place to begin. And sure enough, there were the figures. And the reason nobody had seen them was that in the 1870s, the Victorians, all over Europe, Western Europe in the 19th century, once people realized that prehistory existed and that man had lived alongside extinct animals like mammoths and bison and so on, learned men all over Western Europe, mostly lawyers, teachers, doctors, and clergymen, they would employ laborers to go into caves and rock shelters and dig out the sediments to find the bones of the animals and the stone tools. And Creswell was no exception. So in the 1870s, within a few weeks, workmen had dug out all of the sediments from all of the caves. And in our particular cave, which is called Church Hole, they had therefore dropped the floor by 2 meters, which meant that the art is now way up there and you can't see it unless you're really looking for it. And that's why nobody'd seen it before.
Okay. Wow. What sort of art is it up there in that time period?
Well, we could tell immediately from the style of the animals, because we know styles in Ice Age art very well. We could tell it was what we call late Magdalenian, so something around 13,000 years old. Mm-hmm. And we only have engravings, but we have engravings and bas-reliefs. That is, bas-reliefs where the figure is sort of standing out from the cave wall. And it's a small cave, and most of the stuff is in the entrance chamber. And we've only got like 23 definite figures in there, but I would say three of them are world class. And in fact, one of them is absolutely unique. That's my baby. It's the ibis. We have an ibis on the ceiling of the entrance chamber of the cave in bas relief. It's just beautiful, absolutely beautiful.
Do you know how they do that? That's the kind of the. I think that's one of the first times I've heard of the bas-relief type of style. Do you have any idea how they would have created that?
Yeah, bas-relief is interesting because, I say, engravings is the commonest form of decoration in the Ice Age. You get it everywhere. Mm-hmm. Bas-reliefs, we only get it in daylight areas. You never get them deep inside caves. They're always in the daylight areas, the entrance chambers, or in rock shelters. And for some reason, which we don't understand, we only have them in central and southwest France, in the Dordogne and the Poitou area, and in Britain now. Nowhere else, although the limestone is workable pretty much everywhere, because they would do this with sharp picks, you know, quartzite picks and things like that, and then they would use pebbles and things for polishing the limestone and so on. So we know pretty much how they did it. We've got many of the tools from the French sites for making these sculpted friezes. These are beautiful sculpted bas-relief friezes. The biggest one in France, we've got 18 meters of frieze, beautiful bison, horses, full-size ibex, women. It's just fabulous. So we have three or four friezes in France, and now we've got these couple of bas-reliefs in Britain as well. And interestingly, the French bas-reliefs all have traces of paint on, so we're pretty sure they were all colored originally as well. Creswell Crags, it's too weathered. I've tried with computer enhancement techniques, but there's no trace of pigment there anymore. It's eroded away, but I'm pretty sure it must have been painted originally too.
So now you've found one site in Britain, are you looking for others?
Well, once we'd made the discoveries at Creswell Crags, and of course we continued looking, we looked in every other cave in England that either was occupied in the period or was accessible in the period. And we found nothing. We found animal claw marks, which shows you that we're not actually missing anything. If there were engravings, we'd see them. But one of the reasons, I think, is that many of these caves are incredibly wet, and the walls are covered in calcite, and so there may be all kinds of decoration underneath that. We just can't see it now. So we're going to have to wait for some new technique of being able to see through the calcite to see if there's any art. For example, the richest Ice Age occupation cave in Britain is called Kent's Cavern, down on the south coast at Torquay. Big, big cave, very, very important living site. I'm quite sure it must have been lavishly decorated, but there's absolutely nothing to see now because it's such a wet cave with calcite everywhere. There's a big stalagmite in one chamber in Kent's cavern, and an Irishman chiseled his name into that in the 17th century. And you can barely see his name now for the calcite that's formed over it. So well, there are quite a few caves in Wales, which I still want to have a look at. And who knows, we might find something else. There is another possibility also, which is that underneath our main cave at Creswell Crags, which is called Church Hole, we know there is another cavity underneath it, which is now filled with sediment. And it might just be a cavity a couple of meters deep, or it may be a full-length cave like Church Hole. And I'm desperate to get into there because, you know, it could be Lascaux in there for all we know. I'm in view of the art in Church Hole above it, I would be amazed if there was nothing in the cavity underneath. So that's a project for the future.
Well, let's go back to France and Spain. That's the primary focus of the book, Images of the Past.
Yeah.
What are the most common figures that, for someone that doesn't know anything about this, what are the most common figures that one would find in these caves in France and Spain?
Well, overall in Ice Age art, by far the commonest animals are horses and bovids, that is bison or aurochs, the extinct wild cattle. They dominate. More than half of all figures are those two animals. And they tend to be in the major parts of the cave, the central, the important panels. They tend to dominate there. It's not a 100% rule, but by and large, this is what you find in most of the caves. Then you've got your more peripheral animals, ibex, the wild goat, mammoths, deer. They tend to be sort of on the margins, on the peripheries of these main panels. And then much more rare, you've got, if you like, the dangerous animals. You've got carnivores, rhinos, humans, and they tend to be tucked away in the dark depths of the caves or in little side chambers. So there is patterning to this. There is an awful lot of thought has gone into this. But occasionally, some caves are totally dominated by one animal. The most extreme example is a cave in France called Ruffignac, where you have 160 images of mammoths. There's very little else in that cave. They were mammoth mad in that cave. And we don't know why. It just doesn't obey the rules of all the other caves. Probably more than half of all known images of mammoths in rock art come from that one cave. Other caves are dominated by what we call signs. You get depictions in the caves which we can't read. They seem to be geometric shapes, and so we call them signs. There are simple signs. There are complex signs. Mm-hmm. Most caves have some of them, and some caves have nothing but signs, which is very interesting, and it's frustrating that we can't read them because they're clearly very important, and they probably have a lot of information in them, but we have no way of getting at that information, unfortunately.
Okay. All right. Well, we are going to take our first break. I'll just remind our listeners real quick that if you like what you're hearing, check out arcpodnet.com and you can support us at arcpodnet.com/members. We'll be back in 30 seconds.
This network is supported by our listeners. You can become a supporting member by going to arcpodnet.com/members and signing up. As a supporting member, you have access to high-quality downloads of each show and a discount at our future online store and access to show hosts on a members-only Slack team. For professional members, we'll have training shows and other special content offered throughout the year. Once again, go to arcpodnet.com/members to support the network and get some great extras and swag in the process. That's arcpodnet.com/members.
All right, well, welcome back to the show. We are talking with Paul Bonn about his book on Ice Age art. So we just left off talking about the different symbols and animals and depictions that are found in these caves. And one of the things that really interested me as I was reading through the book was the level of detail of some of these now extinct species that you see in the cave art. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that and sort of how this crosses over different disciplines even.
Well, of course, it's just wonderful to be able to see these animals which were witnessed by these people so long ago and which are no longer with us, particularly the mammoth, of course. And another one is what we call the megaloceros, the extinct giant deer, like an enormous elk with huge antlers. And Mammoths, of course, we found frozen carcasses in Siberia and elsewhere, so we, even without cave art, we'd have a pretty good idea what they looked like. The megaloceros, all we have are skeletons, and it's only through cave art that we know that they had a great hump of muscle on the neck, because that doesn't fossilize, and we know they had diagonal stripes across the body, because, of course, that doesn't fossilize either. So cave art does really give you a window into what some of these extinct animals look like. But you have to be careful not to take it to extremes. There was an example recently where, with new genetic studies, they were able to prove from the DNA of some Ice Age horses in Siberia that some of them had dappled coats, which is a very interesting fact. Nobody was really surprised, but it was nice to have the genetic proof of this. But unfortunately, the scholars involved latched onto one panel of cave art in France, the so-called spotted horses of Pechmel, as being proof that supported their findings. But unfortunately, the spots on the horses of Pechmel have got absolutely nothing to do with their coat, because the spots continue around the horses, and they're far too regular on the coat. They're in no way a depiction of the horse's coat. So you've got to be very careful not to take everything too literally. But certainly, plus, of course, another interesting point is that cave art is not photography. Some of the animals are very naturalistic, as far as we can tell, especially towards the end of the Ice Age. They could draw most beautiful, naturalistic, realistic animals. But in earlier periods, there's a lot of stylization, very schematic animals. So they give them tiny heads and huge bodies and little legs and things like that. So the styles changed through time in the Ice Age. It's not surprising, because they're doing Ice Age art for 20, 30,000 years over a huge expanse of territory. So it's really not surprising that the styles came and went. But some of these styles were very schematic, very stylized, but still very beautiful art. Then the real realism and naturalism really comes to the fore right at the end.
Okay. Dr. Bond, what I'm interested in some of the prevailing theories about what some of this means. I live in the Great Basin in the United States, and we have some fairly abstract rock art over here that people are constantly trying to puzzle out and figure out what's going on with. And the rock art over here is not nearly as old, but when you go back even just a few thousand years, it's very abstract symbols and things like that. And then later on, you get into animals and shapes and things. But these people were doing stylized animals and really good depictions, like you said, 20 to 30,000 years ago. What are some of the prevailing theories on why they may have done this? Was it purely art for art's sake, or was it some sort of hunting magic or something like that, do you think?
Well, right from the beginning, the first thoughts about it were that it was art for art's sake. It was just hunters with time on their hands and some talent. And certainly, I think a certain amount of it can be explained that way. Because if you think about it, if you've got a really, really talented artist, and some of these people, whether men or women, were incredibly talented, then they could certainly make their living that way. You can imagine them traveling around France or Spain and calling up different tribes and saying, if you'll feed me and house me for 2 or 3 weeks, I will decorate your weapons, your tools, your tents, your clothing, your bodies, your caves, whatever. So personally, I think that's very likely that the really, really good artists would have been making a living that way. Then, for the first half of the 20th century, theories of what's called hunting magic came along. And it dominated for so long, really, because of the archaeologists who dominated the scene at the time, and they happened to believe in this theory. But unfortunately, they started twisting the facts to fit the theory instead of getting rid of the theory to fit the facts. They believed that people drew animals in order to be able to go out and kill them, and so you would make a drawing of an animal and then draw missiles on it and, try to kill the image, and that would help you to go out and kill the animal. And, of course, we now know that this is total nonsense. It just doesn't work for a number of reasons. Firstly, we have actually very few images of animals with what could be interpreted as missiles on them. Any cartoonist today who draws cave art, you will have images of animals who look like pincushions and people running after them with bows and arrows and spears and things. It's all total rubbish. We have tens of thousands of images in Ice Age art. We don't have a single hunting scene, not one. It is not an art about hunting. There are a few animals in some caves which seem to our eyes to have missiles on them, but just because that's what they look like to us, is that what they meant 14,000 years ago? We don't know. Sometimes the missiles seem to be coming out of the animals. Sometimes the missiles are nowhere near the animals. And then, of course, you don't know the time relationship between the supposed missiles and the animals. Were they drawn on by the artist who did the animal? Were they put on centuries later? We have no idea. Thirdly, there are very, very few caves that have any examples of those animals. If I try to count them, I can fill one hand. I'm struggling to fill two hands with caves that have images of animals that may have missiles on them. And as I said, we have something like 430 sites now in Eurasia. This is not a key to understanding cave art. And then the final nail in the coffin, really, of that theory is that on the whole, they are not drawing the animals that they're eating. It does correlate sometimes. In northern Spain, they draw a lot of red deer. They ate a lot of red deer. But on the whole, they are not drawing what they're eating. And the ultimate example of that is Lascaux, the richest of all decorated caves in the Ice Age. Lascaux had somewhere between 1,500 and 2,000 animals drawn on its walls. It hasn't got a single picture of a reindeer, but the occupants of Lascaux were reindeer hunters. So, you know, they are not drawing what they're eating. It's not a menu. It's not even a picture of the world outside. It's not a picture of the environment. There are no ground lines. There are very few scenes. There's no vegetation, no sun, no moon. It's just individual animals drawn on the walls. And so I always like to quote the great French anthropologist Levi Strauss, who wrote a very, very important sentence, which was, maybe they're not drawing animals that are good to eat, they're drawing animals that are good to think. And he's much closer to the mark there, because this is a very, very complex phenomenon, Ice Age cave art. It's almost insulting to say that the Ice Age people, if they got peckish, they'd draw a picture of a horse and then they'd try and go out and kill it. These were highly intelligent people. They're exactly the same as we are. They have the same minds, the same intelligence as we are. And so there is tremendous thought and complexity in this art. And what they're trying to convey with the art is clearly important to them and very, very complex. And so the later theories about the art, in particular the theories of the French scholars Lamming-Empereur and Leroy Gourhan, they started to look at the art in and of itself rather than borrowing explanations from Australian Aborigines or Bushmen and so on. They studied the art in and of itself, and that's when we finally got the insights that there is a kind of a code, there is a syntax to this. They are drawing a very restricted range of animals, mostly adults, hardly any young animals. Some animals are often found together, some are never found together. As I said earlier, some are in major panels in the centers of caves, others are in more peripheral locations. There is tremendous thought and planning has gone into the decoration of these caves. And so it's very clear to me that one of the major explanations of this cave art is it's transmitting information in different ways. Hunter-gatherer societies, it's crucial to them to pass information on indelibly to the next generation. And this is not just, you know, tribal lore and creation myths and all that sort of thing. It's also how to deal with drought, how to deal with food crisis, how to get on with your neighbors in times of crisis, that kind of thing. So all of these social rules and regulations and survival rules have got to be passed on. And so I think a lot of cave art is involved with that. The problem is that we can't read it. Now, in more recent years, there's been a resurgence of rather simplistic ideas, again taken from largely from South African Bushmen, trying to link it to shamans going into trance and having vision quests and this sort of thing. But we don't have the slightest evidence for anything of that kind. And again, I think it's sort of insulting to the Ice Age artists to say that they had no imagination and they just slapped on the walls whatever came to them in dreams and visions and so on. No, this is a hugely complex art which is transmitting all kinds of information. And to me, the third explanation, I say the first is talented artists expressing themselves, maybe making a living. The second is the transmission of information of all different kinds. But the third component, which is probably equally important, if not more important, is some of it has to be religious in some way. And the reason for that, the reason why I can feel confident in saying that, is where they are choosing to put it sometimes. Because some of this art is put in very public spaces, in caves or out of doors, where a lot of people could see it. Now, we'll never know who was allowed to see it. Maybe you had to be of a certain age or sex or degree of initiation to see it. That we'll never know. But it is meant for other people to see. On the other hand, we've got a lot of cave art which is hidden away from the world. They crawled into hellish places, really horrible places, and left images which were not meant for other people to see. They are leaving these images for something non-human. Maybe it's a god or a spirit or an ancestor or the forces of nature or something like that. But they are putting themselves through physical hell to leave these images in places that no one is ever going to see them. And to me, that has to be religious, whether they're asking for help or they're thanking for help or something of that kind. However you define religion, it's got something to do with something non-human, and so I would call that religious. So a certain quantity of it, I think, is definitely religious.
Wow. Okay. So first off, thank you for sort of, I guess, debunking the idea that it's, cave art is often related to hunting and things like that. It seems to be such a pervasive idea. Anytime you talk to somebody that doesn't know very much about it, they're like, oh, they're drawing scenes of hunting and animals they want to kill. And yeah. I mean, just the evidence doesn't sound like it's there. Yeah. And I guess the one other thing I wanted to say about that is it's, I know when I'm recording archaeological sites, even ones that are only, 100 years old, like mining sites out here in the Great Basin, I try to sit down on a site and put myself in the mindset of somebody living in that time period and try to figure out, what were they thinking? What was their life like? Because when we try to apply our own experiences and our own world on top of a 25,000-year-old site, we just don't know what their world was like. So that's really cool to, to hear about that. Which leads me to one of my big questions about what you just said is religion. Religion is so subjective, like one person's really difficult to access part of the cave is another person's rite of passage, or they had to get back there to prove they were, part of the tribe or something like that. Do we have evidence leading up to what other evidence of possible religious explanations do you think there are from other sites in the region? Do we know anything about what they may have thought about the afterlife just based on some things other than rock art, maybe some other artifacts and things?
Not really. I mean, the only other evidence really of a belief in something, other than this life is burial, of course. And of course, burials go back at least to Neanderthals, if not further, that we have quite a few burials from the last ice age. But not everybody gets buried. Only certain people seem to get buried. And if you think the whole of Iberia, Spain and Portugal, we don't have a single burial from the last ice age. We've got a child in Portugal, which is a hybrid of Neanderthals and moderns. And then we've got some bones of a woman from a cave called El Mirón now in northern Spain. And that's a secondary burial. And that's all we have for the last ice age in the whole of Spain and Portugal. What were they doing with their dead? We've got quite a few in France and Italy and Russia and Czech Republic. But again, it only seems to be certain people and in certain periods who were getting buried. And being buried, and especially with red ochre and sometimes with nice stone tools and other grave goods, that would certainly indicate some kind of religious belief, I think. Mm-hmm. But beyond that, all we've got to go on, essentially, is where they're choosing to put the cave art in areas that are so private that nobody was meant to see them. The ultimate case, which I like to show in lectures, is a cave in France called Pergouzet. And it's hell to get into this cave. You've got a 150-meter crawl, flat out, pulling yourself with fingers and toes to get in there. And after 150 meters of this hell, you can finally stand up in the cave. And then they started decorating. But the archaeologist who studied it is a man called Michel Loblanchet, who is far and away the greatest scholar we have of cave art. And he spent 10 terrible years studying this cave, poor man. But he found there's a little niche in one wall inside the cave, and he thought he could see something in there, but you can't get your head into the niche. It's far too small. So he inserted a camera and took pictures, and there is an engraving in there of an animal head, and it's very well done. But the artist who reached in there did that entirely by touch. The artist never saw the image. And that is the ultimate to me in private art. This is very hidden art. It has to be religious in some way. Who would ever know that the artist had done that? But the artist did it and did it very well. But it was clearly an offering of some kind to something non-human.
Wow. Yeah, I guess so. Well, you know, maybe one man's crawl through the depths of hell is a Paleolithic resort. You never know. Probably not, though.
It's an interesting point. We do know a lot of children were going into these caves, even the huge caves. Little children were going in there and seemed to have no fear of them at all. And nearly all the footprints that survive are from children and adolescents because they tend to go off the beaten path, so their tracks get preserved. But the most interesting case of that is a cave in the Pyrenees, a huge cave called Neo, and there are the footprints of two or three children in the mud. And people just thought, oh, they'd left them accidentally as they went through the mud. But when these footprints were studied, they discovered that these were kids playing. They were putting their feet into the mud and lifting them out vertically, very carefully, to leave the best prints that they could. And this is nearly a mile into the mountain. So you've got little children playing in the depths of these caves.
Wow.
So you have to bear that in mind. This is an important point I always try to make in lectures, because people tend to assume that anything done in a cave, especially a deep, dark cave, is going to be mysterious and mystical and religious and so on. And some of it probably was, but we can't be sure of that because kids were playing in there. There's a famous case in Chauvet Cave in southeast France, where in one of the decorated chambers, there's a cave bear skull that's been placed on a rock. Now, the cave bear skulls are there naturally, because cave bears die during hibernation, so there's lots and lots of their bones and skulls around. But somebody put this skull on a rock in this chamber. So, of course, it's caused a lot of ink to flow about cave bear cults and the altar and this sort of thing. And that's possible. But to me, it's equally possible that there was a child playing with it. And, you know, its parents said, time for lunch, come out, have your lunch. And it left the skull on the rock and trotted off and had its lunch. And the problem is, we don't know which of those explanations is true, and there are probably several others that have never occurred to us. So you must never jump to what seem to be obvious conclusions in the world of cave art. It's a very, very complex phenomenon.
I feel like somebody must have written in a theory book sometime, when in doubt, it's religious. And then that's all the...
Absolutely.
You know.
Yeah. No, it's an archaeological classic. If you don't know, it's ritual. Yeah,
exactly.
Absolutely.
All right, well, we're going to take our final break, and we'll be back in just a minute to wrap up this discussion with Dr. Paul Bonn about the new book, the new addition to the book, Images of the Ice Age Past. Back in a minute. Hey, podcast fans, check out the ARC365 podcast at www.arcpodnet.com/arc365. That's ARCH365 for your daily dose of archaeology. Each episode is less than 15 minutes long, and we have some great guests recording about awesome archaeology. We also try to throw in some definitions and basic archaeological information. So check out the 365 Days of Archaeology podcast only in 2017 at www.arcpodnet.com/arc365 today. Find us also on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and Google Music by typing ARC365 into the search. Now back to the show.
Hey, well, welcome back to the Archaeology Show. So as we ended our last segment, you were just talking about kind of children in these caves, and that actually brought to me two questions that I've been kind of fermenting as we've been talking, which is first, you know, you mentioned that potentially the art in these caves is made by professional artists, but who can we talk a little bit more about who may have been making these? Because I know in some of them, you know, there are these finger trailings that people have discussed whether or not they're children and adults, and some of the handprint art appears to be mixed ages. So it'd be really interesting to talk a little bit more about who may be making this art a little more broadly, but also, you know, thinking about kids running through these caves makes me wonder, what is the actual environment that a lot of these pieces were being seen in originally? You know, are these many of them in habitation areas
where people are seeing this on a daily basis as compared to the pieces that are in these really hidden parts that might be more religious? So that's a long question for you.
Well, the first thing to bear in mind is that art in deep caves is pretty rare. You know, the vast majority of cave art is in much shallower caves and in rock shelters and now in the open air. So there is not a huge amount of it in very deep caves. Plus, they hardly ever lived in the deep caves. They lived in cave mouths and rock shelters and tents and mammoth bone huts and so on. But we have one or two examples where they did live deep, deep inside the caves. There are fireplaces and structures and things, but they're very, very rare. So to that extent, the cave art is not something they would see all the time. On the other hand, we now know they were doing stuff in the open air, so I'm sure this art was all around them all the time. It's on rocks in the open air, it's on their bodies, it's on their clothes, it's everywhere. So they will be used to seeing it, and that's why the canons of the art will have continued through space and time. Now, the question of children is very interesting. There is one writer who has claimed that because all of the footprints that survive in the caves are children's, therefore they must have done all of the cave art. I think this is utter rubbish. They may have done some of it, and if you've got a very talented child, that child may well have done some cave art. And as you mentioned, there are some finger markings on some walls and ceilings that were done by children. We have some little children's handprints and so on. But the vast, vast majority of Ice Age art, whether it's portable or on cave walls or rock walls, is clearly done by extremely talented adults. Just from the height, the extent of some of the art, the actual manual sweeps of some of the lines drawn, like the Altamira Bison. I mean, this has to be adults, sometimes quite big adults, who did this sort of thing. So I think you can look at it in the same way as, say, an Ice Age tribe and its stone tools. Probably many people in the tribe would be capable of knocking out some basic stone tools and probably had to a lot of the time. So I would think most of the people in the tribe might have been capable of doing some drawings, maybe not very good, but they could do it. But in each tribe, probably, you will have one person who is really, really good at making stone tools or bone tools or making art. And that person will be the one who gets to do most of that work. And we can look at it, if you think about the Australian Aborigines, for example, the areas of Australia where they still produce rock art, rather, particularly the Kimberley of Northwest Australia, even today, the elders of the tribe sort of hold auditions every few years to try and find which of the new generation have got the talent for making rock paintings, and then once they've chosen them, then they start to instruct them in the techniques and the beliefs and the images and this sort of thing. So it's very facile to slap something like that onto the Ice Age. We'll never know, but I think it's fairly likely that in the Ice Age, again, they will have sought out the ones with the talent, the up-and-coming youngsters with the talent, and they would then have been trained to carry on the traditions.
That's really interesting to think about, this sort of idea of it passing down. Because I know earlier you talked about the fact that there are changing styles of Ice Age art. Are there cave settings where you get many of these styles? And so you can sort of thinking a little bit of it as like an art museum where you see, you know, the Impressionists and all the different art movements that we go through.
Fortunately, we have a number of caves where it's pretty clear that one person decorated them. We have Las Monedas in Spain, Covalanas. It's pretty clear one person, it was a private project, one person did the whole cave. On the other hand, we have caves like Lascaux, Altamira, El Castillo, which seem to have been decorated through thousands of years. And so you get all kinds of different styles piling up on top of each other. And we're supremely fortunate in Ice Age art in that alongside all the stuff on the cave walls, we have the portable art, which can be dated. And in the portable art, one of the richest sites we have is a cave in southeast Spain called Parpallo, which had a stratigraphy spanning the whole of the last Ice Age. And within that stratigraphy, there are 5,000 decorated slabs of stone, plaquettes, as we call them, with engravings or paintings on. 5,000 of them with 6,000 decorated surfaces spanning the whole of the last Ice Age. And so Parpallo gives you a wonderful template showing you the changes of style and technique and content right through the last ice age, and that's been tremendously helpful to us in assessing the age of newly discovered caves. And so now that we know the styles of the last ice age so well, it's relatively easy. If a new cave is found, we look at it and we say, oh yeah, that's probably from such and such a period, and on the whole it is. And there are these idiosyncrasies that come and go through time. Just to give you a couple of examples, in what we call the Gravettian period, which is around 26, 27,000 years ago, for some unknown reason, they started drawing mammoths and the tusks come out of the trunk. Now, they know full well the anatomy of the mammoth. They know the tusks don't come out of the trunk, but that's how they drew them. And then it disappears again. So if you find a new cave and it's got mammoths with tusks coming out of the trunk, you know it's Gravettian, and it always is. And another fad that arose and died away again was to make animals and their outlines are done just with red dots, sometimes very separate red dots, sometimes joined together. And we get them in something like, I think, 23 caves in northern Spain, all along the coast of northern Spain. And it arises and then it disappears again. So again, it became fashionable. Somebody had the idea. It caught on and then it died away again. So, and then underneath that, you have the underlying themes which go on right through the Ice Age, the same limited range of animals drawn in the same way and this sort of thing. But on top of that, you do get these regional fads and trends that come and go, which is fascinating.
That is so interesting to me, because it's almost like what they say about laws in geology is what holds true now probably holds true in the past. And, you know, when you look at art back through the whole, you know, really written period of human history, there were stylistic differences, which, you know, with you just saying that, you know, drawing tusks coming out of the trunk and the red dots and things like that, man, that almost just like seals the deal for the fact that they were just doing art practically. You know, they were expressing themselves in these ways and using the stylistic thoughts of the period. That's so amazing.
And you will occasionally get the odd maverick, the odd Picasso, who will pop up and do something totally different, and it catches on and then it dies away again. It was probably frowned upon originally, and then okay, we'll do that.
We all think we're unique, don't we? But nothing ever really changes, does it? So speaking of styles, along with the visual stylistic differences, were there differences in or fads, let's say, in the way the pigment was applied to the cave? Because I've seen different things about, you know, spitting the pigment onto the wall. You know, we always talk about drawing. What are some of the ways that some of this stuff actually got on the wall with these pigments?
Well, they've got a whole range of different ways, and they mastered all of them. I mean, the simplest way to mark walls is just to do it with the finger, and we've already mentioned there are finger markings if the wall and ceiling are soft enough. Then engraving, of course, any sharp flint will do. You don't need a technical, you know, a specialist tool for this. Any sharp flint will enable you to engrave on the walls. Then you need picks to make bas reliefs and sculptures. And then moving into pigments, the simplest way to apply a pigment to the wall is just to have like a crayon of ochre or manganese, and you just draw with it, and they did that sometimes. Or you grind it up into a powder and mix it usually with saliva and spit it or spray it onto the wall. Or you can apply it with, we've never found a brush. They must have had brushes, it's pretty clear, but we've never found one. None has survived. And then, of course, you can apply the pigment to the wall with fingers, as I've said, the red dot technique. Sometimes they use pads, all kinds of different ways of doing it.
Did that change through time? Just like the were there? I guess when you look at what I'm saying is, when you look at some of the fads and the styles, were those often done in the same way, or would you see elephants with tusks coming out of the trunk, all done in the same artistic style? You know, the same method used to create it.
It's hard to see any changes or developments of techniques through time because, well, the vast majority of cave art is still really undated. But even knowing the styles and so on, they were doing all of these things all at the same time, depending on what materials they had available to them and what pigments were available and so on. So you can't really say in this period they did this. The hand stencils, the spraying of pigment onto the hands, they do seem to be a very early phenomenon, and you don't get that happening later on. They were still spitting and spraying. The spotted horses of Peshmer that I mentioned were done by spraying or spitting. A lot of the Lascaux paintings were done by spraying or spitting. But for some reason, hand stencils seem to be very, very early, to the extent that it's now looking as if Neanderthals were doing that as well. As you may know, we have some dating from calcite covering paintings in northern Spain. Mm-hmm. And there's a hand stencil in El Castillo cave, and the calcite covering it is nearly 40,000 years old, meaning the hand stencil has to be older than that. Wow. And we have very similar dates now for hand stencil in a cave in Borneo. So it's looking as if people very, very long ago were doing this stuff. And there are more dates in the pipeline, which I'm sworn to secrecy on, but there are more dates coming from northern Spain that will make it absolutely certain that Neanderthals were doing cave art, which is very, very exciting. But yes, it's odd that the hand stencil, which is a ubiquitous thing, you find it in rock art all over the world, but in the Ice Age, you only really get it in the early periods, and then they stop doing it for some reason.
Hmm. Okay.
After about maybe 25,000, you just don't get them anymore.
Right. All right. Well, we are coming to the end of this discussion. Is there anything that we didn't ask you related to the book or Paleolithic rock art that you wanted to mention?
The one thing which I would like to mention, because it's dear to my heart, is my belief that the very early dates for Chauvet Caves art are completely erroneous. There are quite a number of us who are trying to get this established in the literature, but it's very, very hard because the Chauvet research team simply refused to debate and discuss this. Hmm. And officially, now all of the art in Chauvet is 36,000 years old, and I think that's utter nonsense. It just doesn't fit with all the rest of Ice Age art, everything that we know about Ice Age art, the styles, the techniques, and so on. And to the extent that if those dates are correct, and we know they're not, but if they were correct, you would have to rewrite all the books on Ice Age art and turn it into two phases. And the first phase would be Chauvet Cave, and the second phase would be all the rest of Ice Age art, and there is no connection between the two. And it's perfectly clear from the styles and the techniques and the content of Chauvet's art that the red figures are Gravettian in the 20,000s, and the black figures are later Solutrean Magdalenian going up to the end of the Ice Age. That fits beautifully with what we know from more than 100 years of study, what we know about Ice Age art. It's just utterly ridiculous to claim that Chauvet is the oldest art in the world, which in any case it isn't, now that we have these Neanderthal dates from Spain elsewhere. But unfortunately, that's now in all the books, all the textbooks, that Chauvet is the oldest art in the world. And it annoys me because it really doesn't matter. Chauvet is still one of the most fantastic decorated caves ever found, certainly in the top three or four. And it doesn't matter that it's not the oldest. It's still fantastic cave art. But unfortunately, this battle has been raging for some time now and shows no sign of being resolved.
Wow.
So after hearing about all of these sites and then looking at the images in the book, my first instinct was to want to go and see all of these sites. And I know that many of our listeners will be wondering, how many of these cave art sites are accessible to the public?
Well, as it happens, I have published the only guidebook there is to all of the decorated caves open to the public. And there is a new edition coming out next April, not from Oxford University Press, I'm afraid, but nevertheless, the book is called Cave Art, a Guidebook to the Decorated Caves. There are about 50 original caves which you can still visit, mostly in France and Spain, a couple in Italy, and of course, Creswell Crags in Britain is also open to the public. There are a growing number of facsimiles as well, because you can't see the original Lascaux and Altamira or Chauvet, but there are excellent facsimiles of those and one or two other caves which you can visit. But for seeing, there's no substitute really for seeing original Ice Age cave art, and there are about 50 sites where you can still do that. And I lead tours every year for two or three companies leading tours to the caves of France and Spain, and they're very popular. People just love to see this art. I often have people in tears in front of the art because it is so powerful to see something so beautiful that was made so many thousands of years ago It is a very, very impressive phenomenon.
Great. Well, we'll have to check that book out and maybe have you on again when that comes out. That sounds fantastic.
Excellent. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. So one final thing, I did notice in some online resources about you that you occasionally do lecture tours. Do you still do those?
I'm always available for lectures, bar mitzvahs, or anything of the kind. I'm anybody's for a free Coca-Cola, actually. But I lecture a lot for something. Well, it used to be called NABFAS. Now it's called the Arts Society, and this is a British-based thing, but it has outshoots in other places. And for example, I've got to do a lecture tour of Australia in early 2019 for them. But no, I'm always happy to come out and do lecture tours. I did one for the AIA, the Archaeological Institute of America, some years ago, mostly in New England. But no, always happy to come out. In fact, I came out and did a couple in Vegas and Reno a few years ago, which gave me the chance to see your rock art, which was very, very interesting.
Excellent, excellent. Yeah, Reno's where I'm at right now. So,
yeah.
Okay. Well, outstanding. Well, this lecture you just did went out to about 4,000 people, so that's not too bad.
Right.
So, well,
especially if they all buy the book.
I know, right? Well, we'll get the links from Oxford University Press. They'll be in the show notes. So check out the episode show notes at archpodnet.com/archaeology/29 for the link to this book from Oxford University Press. And again, thank you, Dr. Paul Bond, for being on the show.
My pleasure.
All right. And thanks, everybody. And we'll see you next time. Thanks for listening to the Archaeology Podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. You can provide feedback using the contact button on the right side of the website at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/archaeology. Or you can email chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Please like and share the show wherever you saw it so more people can have a chance to listen and learn. Send us show suggestions and follow ArcPodNet on Twitter and Instagram. This show is produced by the Archaeology Podcast Network. Opinions are solely those of the hosts and guests of the show. However, the APN stands by their hosts. Special thanks to the band Sea Hero for letting us use their song I Wish You'd Look. Check out their albums on Bandcamp at seahero.bandcamp.com. Check out our next episode in 2 weeks, and in the meantime, keep learning, keep discovering new things, and keep listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network. Have an awesome day. This show is produced by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 US a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to archpodnet.com/members for more info.